We acknowledge that we are on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples' spirit, imagination, and rich history of storytelling and humour that is an inspiration for all Australians.
Hello, my name is Matt Harvey, and it is 2024, which means that this is not only a new episode, but a whole new year of the Bearer of Weird News, as always. I will be your host and the suppository of all wisdom for another year of news-related stupidity, as the most delicate slices of Wagyu news are served, medium well done, and only slightly bloody. As I, your faithful news companion, bring you the freshest news I spent the night hunting in a subtle hint that although I like you enough to bring you news, I don't trust you or your hunting skills. This episode is brought to you by the changing of the Lunar New Year, that's right. And this year is the Year of the Dragon. The dragon, a historical symbol for power and knowledge and greed and hoarding. Effectively, the Middle Ages Jeff Bezos, down to not having any hair. Possibly the most famous of the dragons is the historical fictional Smaug with his Mountain of Gold. Smaug holds the inauspicious position of being the second richest fictional character with an estimated value of $51.4 billion in stolen gold, which as of 2023 makes him the 23rd on the richest in the world list. 23rd. So this year, to celebrate the Year of the Dragon, we will be forced to spend the year ruminating on how having an entire mountain of gold in this day and age is not enough to even get you into the top 20 of richest people in the world, and how all it took to take Smaug down was a carefully placed arrow in the chest, and eventually his gold was distributed amongst everyone who helped in the Battle of the Five Armies. This podcast isn't a military psyop, but remember, the day will come when you are asked to help take down a dragon, and when that day comes, be prepared to stand up and do your part in World War III, class warfare. Big thanks to both Perth and Rockingham, and to all the people who not only turned out, but were very into the material of the show. A lot of fun stories were shared with me after these shows, and I enjoy that quite a lot. So if you want to come out and see the show and maybe share a story or two, you're more than welcome to. And you'll be able to do that in a couple of different places. So if you don't know, I am performing my storytelling and stand-up show titled Wage Against the Machine in the following places. In the Adelaide Fringe from the 29th of February until March 10th at the Hotel Richmond. For the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, basically for the entire month except for Monday. So from March 29th until April 21st at Kaz Rytops. And most importantly, the Tuesday to Thursday shows are pay what you can, because I understand it's been a tough couple of years, and we'll see if we can reshape this whole comedy thing in a bit more of a egalitarian way. So if you can afford to get yourself to the show, then you can chuck whatever you want in the bucket at the end. Basically, make me work for it. Also, I've been accepted in the Sydney Comedy Festival for the first time, which will be fun to go and check that out. I've only got two shows there though, May 4th and May 5th, but they're both at the Enmore Theatre. But as always, I'll be adding new shows to this tour, heading around hopefully to somewhere near you. So if you've got a festival that happens near you, feel free to hit me up and let me know that it's there. And of course, guys, don't forget, I am producing. I won't be in it, but I am producing on a play called The Platypus on June 19th till July 6th as part of Theatre Works in 2024, which has been written and directed by the wonderful Francis Greenslade, who you may know from Mad as Hell. So the play is incredibly funny, you take my word for it, it's very moving, and you should go to the Theatre Works website and book yourself some tickets for that. Until then, guys, I will be the bearer of weird news. So let's get into the headlines. Seems Kathy Freeman's 400 meter dash to gold at the Sydney 2000 Olympics has been voted the winner of the inaugural Guardian poll of Australia's greatest sporting moments. And don't get me wrong, guys, it's a great moment, but our greatest sporting moment? Greatest? I don't think so. Seems a lot of you have forgotten the sporting gem that was Scott Morrison knocking over a child. Let's have a clip. And let's do it again. Sporting gem of the century. It just really shows the Australian people how he really felt about the future generations. Pope Francis has said that surrogacy is deplorable and has called for a global ban. Now, I'm not one for casting dispersions, but I'm starting to think that maybe, just maybe, the church isn't the right moral authority to tell people what they should and shouldn't stick in somebody else's body. I just heard a couple of things, if you know what I mean. I mean, at least the surrogates are consenting. The Colombian city of Barranquilla has unveiled a monumental 21-foot statue of its most famous former citizen, Shakira. Now, much like the woman herself, the statue will cast a large shadow over the town and will refuse to pay any taxes. Unpublished data revealed more than 3/4 of Australian students say that they didn't fully try in the latest international student assessment tests. Or at least, that's what they said after seeing their results. You'll notice nobody from the top 25% is claiming that they didn't really try. No. They're busy getting on the waiting list for an early stress-inducing breakdown. North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un is believed to have turned 40, but North Korean state media has never really confirmed the exact date of his birthday. Now, if this is true, state media aren't doing him any favours, because let's be honest, guys, he's not a very good 40. They should go hard in the other direction. Take after his dad and just start telling everyone that he's like 60 or 70. Doesn't he look good for 60? I think for a 60-year-old man, Kim Jong-un, looking pretty good. If you're gonna do propaganda, at least do it properly. Do it in a way that makes them seem better than they are. I think that's the whole point of propaganda. More civilians were recorded as being killed or injured by airstrikes, bombs, or artillery during 2023 than in any other year for more than a decade due to the high number of casualties from the 3-month war in Gaza, which, if history is any indication, this will put Netanyahu in the running for a Nobel Peace Prize, although he just prefers if people call him the Michael Jordan of war crimes. He may even get the coveted product deal with Lockheed Martin. That's a hard deal to get, guys. An Amazon warehouse told workers facing financial hardship that they may get help if they write a letter to the company's orange blob mascot, Pecky. Select employees will be chosen to have some of their wishes fulfilled. And people say that Amazon is a cruel and heartless company. Come on, guys. Select poverty-stricken employees will have some of their wishes fulfilled. It's official. Amazon, for kindest corporate entity since the Wonka factory opened, a recent scientific review has shed light on sarcasm's impact on what they call perspective taking, or the ability to see things from another person's point of view. You can read all about it in the next issue of The Magazine. Peter Dutton has told Australians to boycott Woolworths and Big W following its decision not to sell Australia Day merchandise. His exact words were, "I don't care if people aren't buying them anymore. You keep selling the same old shit forever. It's how we run the Liberal Party. We're doing just fine." That story again. The party who claims to love the free market and hate wokeism, furious to see that the free market has gone woke and called for further boycott of said free market. In response, Woolworths has said that while they aren't selling Australia Day merchandise, Australians can still celebrate Australian culture at Woolworths by treating a low-income worker like shit and allowing a coalition leader to drag us behind America into some kind of unnecessary culture war. It's the Australian way. After 95 years, the Steamboat Willie version of Mickey Mouse has finally entered the public domain, allowing artists to use the mouse copyright free. Upon hearing the news, DeviantArt artists were confused why any artist would wait until Mickey Mouse had entered into the public domain to draw some sort of big dick on him, saying, I mean, we've been doing it for years here. I got a really good one with Goofy, if you can't wait until Goofy goes into the public domain. During a campaign rally in Iowa, Trump was speaking to a crowd complaining about electric catapults and magnetic elevator systems on US aircraft carriers when he made a surprising announcement.
Now, all I know about magnets is this. Give me a glass of water. Let me drop it on the magnets. That's the end of the magnets.
Now, for those in the know, it was clearly a dog whistle that Trump intends to announce his bid to join the Insane Clown Posse. Yes, courting the Juggalo vote, he took the Juggalo name Insurrectionist Jay, then sprayed the crowd with Faygo, yelling, whoop whoop. It was a bit of a no-brainer for Trump after he realized that he's been a Juggalo the whole time. Think about it. He wears baggy clown pants, he has a face full of makeup, ridiculous hair, and he doesn't understand magnets. I mean, how do they even work?
Water, fire, air, and dirt. Fucking magnets. How do they work?
A new AI model uses sequences of life events, such as health history, education, job, and income, to predict everything from a person's personality to the end of their lifespan. Yeah, look, guys, it turns out it's very easy to know when a human will die when you're the one organizing all of them to be wiped out on the same day. Very simple prediction. We're going to move on now to some bigger news. So first up, it is Succession news. Yes. Yeah. So it turns out, despite unpopular demand, there's still many royal families that rule entire countries for some reason. And after Netflix put an end to The Crown following the death of Queen Elizabeth, and HBO Succession finished, leaving a hole in our hearts for dramatic television about people who have entirely too much money. So in order to fill that hole, which we hate that we need to fill, but we'll desperately do anything and support anyone who can fill it, this time we're going to turn to the Danish to do that very thing. You see, the Danes have stepped into the abyss, reminding the world that they too have a royal family, which they can exploit for content, turning them into an extremely short limited season reboot slash remake of Succession, as Queen Margrethe II did the exact thing that we could never convince Elizabeth to do. She abdicated from the throne, leaving a bigger power vacuum than when Hamlet's dad died, and offering up an opportunity for a review. That's right, it's time for a review. First thoughts on this Danish season of Succession. So the Danish reboot of Succession is missing some of the intrigue of its American counterpart, while the HBO masterpiece stretched the titular Succession out for four seasons of prestige drama, leaving us to contemplate who'd be the eventual head of Waystar Royco. It really seemed like they only had one person in mind the entire time for this Danish reboot, as, spoiler alert, King Frederick X succeeded his mother as the monarch of Denmark. Sorry if you haven't watched it already, guys. Look, they didn't even have any sort of magical objects, you know, introducing the unexpected element of magical realism that the UK reboot introduced, which I personally don't think served much of a purpose, or, you know, didn't really fit the niche of that gritty realism of the franchise that they did in the American version. But it was fun to see their take on it in the UK. I'm kind of glad they left him out, if I'm honest with you. I'm kind of glad that they left it out. In a clear homage to the original Succession, the inclusion of an Australian in the cast is very welcome. The original Australian being the award-winning powerhouse Sarah Snook, although this particular Australian, Queen Mary, the former advertiser and real estate manager, has all the gravitas of a former real estate agent manager. Frankly, royalty was the natural next step for someone whose living was derived directly from overcharging the poor for their basic needs and services. So this seems like a next logical step for her. Now, fans of the original show will remember that Logan Roy made an untimely and unexpected death in early season 4, whereas this current reboot has effectively robbed us of one of life's joys, that being watching a pompous, overblown oligarch come to a grueling death at the hands of their own immense wealth, the only satisfaction we, the working class, will get as long as we keep capitalism at the helm. But hey, they can't get it all right. They also failed to include what was, without a doubt, the best part of the show, the presence of the family's idiotic social-climbing bumbler. For the Roys, it was Cousin Greg, and for the Royals, it was their UK cousin, the pizza-loving, incapable of sweating Cousin Andrew. Overall, the reboot lacked the substance, a mere blip in history that will fail to leave a mark on culture. I'm already forgetting it as I finish this review. We haven't seen a Danish story with this little action since Hamlet. Ultimately leaving us with the only question we need answered. To reboot or not to reboot? That is the question. To which the answer, in this case, probably you shouldn't have bothered. Moving on, guys, going to go to archive news now, and 2024 has been a big year for secret papers coming to light. Recently, some cabinet papers from the Howard era were released to the public, sending us back to the heady days of 2003, when the world was swept up in the joy of hey ya, cargo pants had yet to be relegated strictly to ticket inspectors, and we didn't yet know that the Hulk and the Pirates of the Caribbean movies would span into franchises that would still be releasing movies to this day. SARS was all the rage in China. MySpace would open the Pandora's box of social media. We also entered into one more multi-year endeavor, the war in Iraq. If you'd have asked me in 2003, I never would have guessed that MySpace and Marvel movies would outlast a war for oil. But time makes fools of us all. But some things are as reliable as climate change causing a natural disaster. One of those inevitabilities is Scott Morrison fucking up some important paperwork. And on that note, the Morrison government failed to hand over some national security related documents meant to be made public to the National Archives of Australia in 2020, claiming the oversights were likely due to disruptions caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. Oh! Are we still planning the pandemic for stuff? That's great! That's fantastic, because I've got a bunch of things, a few real doozies lined up that I really need someone or something that isn't me in order to blame them on. It's just good to know that it's not just the supermarket still riding the high of pandemic blame, that the rest of us can get in on it too. So, back in 2003, Australia joined the US-led invasion of Iraq. Not just because they are a strong trading partner, but because we saw the devastating results of France saying no to the invasion. Remember when Americans were so incensed that they unleashed their deadly consequences that France is still reeling from, still feeling to this day? If you don't remember, they changed the name of French fries, a product that was developed in Belgium, and they renamed them Freedom Fries. I don't know if France will ever recover, if I'm honest with you. That's a cultural scar that doesn't heal. And Australia has so little cultural capital as it is that we can't actually afford to have them take away references to Foster's, a drink that no Australian has ever drunk, or to stop saying, put another shrimp on the barbie, a phrase that no Australian has actually ever used, because, let's be honest, we call shrimp prawns, and that's not really how I think any of us have ever cooked a shrimp or a prawn. Or have them stop making reference to the dingo ate my baby thing, a case where an innocent woman actually went to jail for a murder that she didn't commit, but to be fair, her voice was kind of funny, so, why not? We'd never recover. We don't have enough Hemsworths left in order to recover from that. What would continue to be an increasingly bad habit from future coalition governments, the decision to enter Iraq occurred without detailed paperwork. Much like with Boba debt, the lives of vulnerable people would be harmed purely based on oral reports by the Prime Minister. Now, fortunately, times have changed since 2003. A modern coalition government would never make such a big and devastating decision based on no research or intelligence at all. No. They learned from this mistake and we're sure to at least commission paperwork in the future. Then they could either just ignore that paperwork or make sure that it never got finalized so that they could say that they never received it before acting on absolutely no intelligence and doing whatever they were going to do anyway. See? That is what we call an evolution of government policy. The record of the cabinet's decision contains no mention of any doubt about Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's continued possession of weapons of mass destruction. So for those who weren't there at the time, this was a key justification for the war that really we should never have been a part of, which then fell away mere months later after searches failed to turn up any of the aforementioned weapons of mass destruction. But we are nothing if not a thorough coalition of countries. And so just to be sure, we would spend a further 8 years searching for WMDs as we realized we hadn't looked under any of the couches or behind any of the fridges the first time, and so we'd have to make sure, so we'd have to like go back around and do it all again. After all, the document said, the cabinet further noted that Australia's goal in participating in any military enforcement action would be disarmament of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. So we really, really needed to make sure that we found some, or else we'd have to upgrade this from an archival gaffe to some sort of full-blown historical whoopsie-doodle on the same scale as other historical whoopsie-doodles like that one kerfuffle in the 1940s. The Defence Minister at the time, Robert Hill, said he believed the government made the right decision on the information that was available at the time. Now, that being that there was definitely oil in the region and it didn't currently belong to us. But we could probably change that if we were willing to work hard enough, and we were the coalition of the willing, so we would work hard enough. Albo, however, was less than impressed with this news, ordering an inquiry into why some records surrounding the invasion were kept secret. Have we got a clip?
Let me make it very clear of what my government's position is. Australians have a right to know the basis upon which Australia went to war in Iraq. Australians lost their lives during that conflict, and we know that some of the stated reason for going to war was not correct. Australians do have a right to know what the decision-making process was, and my government believes that this mistake must be corrected, that the National Archives of Australia should release all the documentation that has been provided to them, having account for any national security issues.
Yeah, you tell them, Albert. So committed are they to this lack of intervention in the Middle East, they have even refused to help the good people of Palestine in the face of an obvious genocide, lest that they be painted by the historical brush of impropriety. Although the consequences of war weren't confined to the war zone, certainly not, with Iraq on the verge of chaos, Cabinet discussed the involuntary removal of refugees. And it didn't even take long to get to that point where we're making that discussion. It's almost as if that was what they wanted to do all along. See, in June of 2003, mere months after joining the invasion, and with the country on the brink of a full-blown civil war, the Howard government discussed how refugees created by the conflict could be sent back voluntarily or involuntarily. Well, no wonder these hard-line conservatives love Howard so much. Even now, he stands by his principles, those being, why would anyone support multiculturalism and why would anyone take responsibility for what they've done in the past? Who knows? What a silly way to live. People were into it though, this hardline stance on immigration, including a ramp up of offshore detention, was key to Howard's electoral success. See, his decision to deploy SAS troops to prevent the Tampa, a Norwegian vessel that had rescued 433 refugees from reaching Christmas Island in the lead up to the 2001 election, is still considered a major factor in his victory. They'd eventually compromise with sending refugees back and instead create a sort of extended limbo, instead keeping them under the constant fear of death or deportation that they called immigration detention, a modern terra nullius, taking a section of established land, displacing the native population on behalf of a foreign government and containing unjustified prisoners there. It's a true return to form for Australia. I mean, prison colonies, creating smaller and smaller prison colonies, sort of like babushka prisons, just more and more prisoners just crammed inside other prisons. But that's enough war talk. What else did we learn from these papers? Well, hey, check this out. Turns out the Howard government fought strongly against recognizing the rights of Indigenous peoples to self-determination, even working secretly with Canada to try to change a draft UN declaration on the rights of Indigenous peoples. But Australia's talks with Canada on amendments were being pursued with no Indigenous consultation about the process or its product, as such input would be premature, right? Wouldn't it? Of course, by premature, they do mean something that we would never, ever, ever actually do, but fuck, it sounds good, doesn't it? And it would be premature, because I mean, they don't even have a voice to Parliament now, so doing it 20 years ago, oh, that's way ahead of its time. Unsurprisingly, Howard's government ultimately opposed the declaration when it was adopted by the UN General Assembly in 2007, with 143 countries voting in favour and just 4 voting against. Do you care to guess which one said no? Give me a second to contemplate that. Have you got your thoughts out? Yeah, in all likelihood, you nailed it. Ready? It's Australia, it's Canada, it's New Zealand, and the United States. A quadrumvirate of disappointment, if ever there was one. More a coalition of the unwilling. Howard said the decision wasn't difficult at all, unsurprisingly. You might think that this is a callous way to behave, but it's all in keeping with his people's whitest traditions. You know, a bunch of white people got together and decided the fate of multitudes of Indigenous populations, usually for the worse. It's the colonial way, guys. We're going to move on now. It is bird news. Birds. They're modern society's tiny little delicious dinosaurs. Instead of roaming the earth and working for the evil Ruyon Alliance as the antagonist to the Dino Riders, or eating a lawyer on the toilet, they've taken dominion of the air. And frankly, they can stay up there, terrorizing worms that dare to rise early and dive bombing fish and using their aerial superiority to steal potato cakes from the hands of innocent train passengers who already had to suffer the indignity of riding public transport, let alone having their precious potato cake pilfered by tiny dinosaurs from the air. Not to get too specific about it, but they can stay in the air. Australian citizens will be familiar with the yearly ritual that is ducking for cover from dive bombing terrorists from the sky, the ones that we call birds. Well, one year 3 student was partaking in the time-honoured ritual of laughing at others who were caught up getting swooped while you stay in a nearby relatively safe place. But she wanted to know more. She didn't think laughing was enough. She wanted to know why magpies swoop. The kid noticed that the resident magpie, who goes by the name Mr. Swoops a lot, had been swooping all the dads and wondered why. Fortunately, she's only in the third grade, which means she's not perpetually online, so this didn't get back to the likes of Jordan Peterson, who could have, you know, some strong thoughts on the misandry of birds, mostly swooping men. Oh, you see, magpies are not mere creatures of chaos, but rather they embody a deep-seated archetype within their natural order. It is within their very essence to defend their nests vigorously to safeguard their offspring against perceived threats. But this misandry is nothing but mere virtue signalling, a performative hostility towards men. I have no idea what his voice actually sounds like. I assumed I nailed it. She's really dodged a bullet with that one though, hasn't she? We don't need any more people exposed to that sort of nonsense anywhere, and I apologise for exposing you to it. But if you've ever wondered what the criteria for getting swooped was, you might be a little bit surprised, because it seems magpies swoop bald men more often. Really, magpies? Bald men? As if they didn't have a bad enough time with their major representatives being Mr. Burns, Lex Luthor, and Jeff Bezos. They don't need this. They don't need this from you. You know what? No. Actually, no. Take it all back. I'm flip-flopping on my position on this. I have it all wrong. You swoop away, Comrade Bird. You swoop away. Sorry, bald men, but this is a necessary sacrifice in order to allow the magpies the possibility that one of these swoops will remove the scourge that is Jeff Bezos from the world. Sorry, guys, you've got to take one for the team so that we can take down the Bez. In fact, if we could get some funding, maybe build some tiny little dynamite vests for them, strap them to every magpie, and invite Jeff to as many parks as possible. I think that sounds like a solid investment of some of our science dollars to me. Although, you should know, dear listener, it's still only a gamble, as the data clearly shows that it's not just bald men who get swooped, it's men who are balding on top who were swooped the most. It's the look that we call the Mr. Burns, or as it's most known locally, the John Howard. So you can see why these magpies have been targeting balding men the most. Magpies, they're smart birds. They remember faces. And they live in multi-generational clans. And most importantly, they hold grudges. You see, your average magpie will live for around 25 years. There is bound to be an ancient magpie somewhere who lived through the Howard era and has seen the devastation wrought by this man's neglect. A kind of Lord of the Wings, parroting tales from generation to generation, furious over the Howard era dumping of emissions trading schemes, which had devastating impacts on climate change. This ancient avian lived just long enough to see the release of these foul Howard era archives, reigniting the fury at the full disregard for the environment on display, and he is now taking younger generations under his wing to teach them the subtle art of revenge. Moving on now, it is terrible tech news. It's terrible tech news time, guys. Time to touch base with the world of terrible tech innovations and see what our tech bro overlords think is the best way to turn the future into money, or figure out which modern day human rights people will stop caring about if we make the cost of living bad enough. Come on, hunting the rich, we're gonna get there one day. I know it. So what do we got? It is, no. We're not hunting the rich just yet. Okay, I mean, honestly, guys, how bad do things have to get before we deal out some French-style haircuts, eh? Hey? Speaking of France, let's check in with the home of the Hundred Years Revolution. Well, France is so dedicated to this reputation of the revolution that they wrote a musical about it. And they don't just write musicals about any old household thing, right? Only hard-hitting matters like, I don't know, teenage depression or escaping the Nazis or the American Revolution or how long a year is exactly. Or maybe just like an hour of naming cats. And sometimes they write songs about bestiality. These are all the things that really matter. So what we've been up to, France. France has been making news recently with a series of riots and protests about things being pretty fucking bad. Bad enough that the French people who, despite what World War II enthusiasts will insist, don't stand for a lot of rubbish, for at least not for very long. So on that note, France's privacy watchdog said it slapped Amazon's French warehouse business with a 32 million euro fine for using an excessively intrusive system to monitor worker performance and activity. The watchdog's investigation is focused on employees' use of handheld barcode scanners to track packages at various points as they move through the warehouse, pointing out the obvious that the scanner brought by the megacorporation that hates its employees allows said megacorporation to monitor them, keeping a special eye on inactivity exceeding 10 minutes or if items are scanned too quickly, say in less than 1.25 seconds. They even monitor the first time between the employee's entry into the warehouse and the start of work. Because, as we all know, Amazon workers aren't allowed to have any downtime, be it from getting work done quickly or taking a piss. As the Amazon handbook states, if you have time to pee, you have time to do more work. Get back to work, why aren't you working? It doesn't rhyme like the time to lean saying does, but it really pushes home their feelings about their employees. And besides, paying someone to come up with a pithy rhyme, that's just a waste of money as far as Amazon is concerned. And paying is exactly what they don't want to do. So workers in the US have complained of similar surveillance issues, but it is the US, so instead of acting on it, the Defense Department actually gave Amazon a grant to develop better measures of monitoring their workers for no reason. No reason that you need to know about at all. You hear me? Now I say management is definitely monitoring the employees. But here's the thing. These scanners aren't the only monitoring device out there for the employees. Amazon keeps cameras monitored by managers and AI trained on them at all times. The videos are, at times, flagged for workers in India to review. Workers who, in a pretty typical act of capitalism, have said they're also under constant productivity monitoring. A perfect panopticon, a low-income Ouroboros of plausible deniability. See, if the employees are monitoring each other, then management is not involved, right? And these fines will logically need to be distributed among the workers for bullying their fellow workers, and management will have nothing to do with it at all. Genius, really. Amazon responded with a lengthy statement justifying its warehouse management styles, saying these systems were standard as practice for the industry. And they'd know because they own most of the industry at this point. They just keep buying out smaller and smaller outlets, lowering their costs until the point where there are no other people in the industry. It's just them. They claim they strongly disagree with their conclusions, claiming they use the system to manage its business and meet performance targets. Going on to saying, you know, you'd think we'd be able to inspire them to stop taking toilet breaks without some sort of advanced technology in this post-whipping employees age, but here we are. Money doesn't grow on trees, right? It must be extracted through deception. Just ask Starbucks, who were just accused of rigging payments in their app for a nearly $900 million gain over 5 years by another consumer watchdog group. Watchdogs out there doing their best. So what has Starbucks been doing? Well, it turns out Starbucks has been rigging its payment platform so that consumers are encouraged to leave unspent money on their cards and apps. So customers were exploited via the gift card and app payment system, forcing them to enter a spending cycle where they will never be able to fully spend the remaining balance of prepaid amounts. See, customers can only reload money in $5 increments with a $10 minimum purchase. I see. It seems they have been taking notes from my local laundromat. After I got a washing machine, I had to abandon a single dollar to the system in order to escape it forever. Still the best dollar that I have ever spent. But it's just a few dollars here and there. Matt, why are you being like this? Why are you being so pedantic over a few little dollars? Well, those few dollars here and there over 5 years, they add up, my friends. They add up, giving Starbucks nearly, as I said, $900 million in unspent gift card and app money as corporate revenue, boosting corporate profits and inflating executive bonuses. But at least they made sure the money went to those who need it the most. Those CEOs have no marketable skills. They've spent their working life exploiting others to earn a living. You've never learned to look after themselves. You know the old saying, give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day. Teach a man to fish, and he will eat for a lifetime. Well, nobody taught them to fish. Now, they just grab any bit of fish that they find lying around. It's a tragedy, really. A true tragedy. They'll need all the help that they can get. Maybe that we should set up like a Patreon for them so that they don't die. It would be appropriate because this complaint, this system, has been likened to an involuntary subscription. A Patreon that you've never signed up to. Basically, it's like forgetting to unsubscribe at the end of a free trial. But the subscription is for more capitalism. It's always for more capitalism. Moving on now, guys, it is robot news. Robots, the savior and destroyer of mankind, conveniently stored in a single package for you. Starting down the path towards a nexus point. See, robots are muscling their way into jobs and starting to take over. And we, with all of our spare time, will finally have the chance to be free of shitty labor. Although needing to fight for the right to be exploited by our employers because, I mean, after all, we still need money. So we're going to be fighting our own replacements to get back into the jobs that we hated in the first place. Huzzah! With this nexus point growing closer and robots getting better at pretending that they are us, we have entered a number of serious conversations about the lifespan left to us if we allow companies who can't even keep the phrase "don't be evil" in their own personal philosophies. So with that in mind, Google has written a robot constitution with the hopes that its machines won't kill you. This constitution is reportedly inspired by Isaac Asimov's three laws of robotics. So for the uninitiated, those are: one, a robot may not injure a human, or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Two, a robot must obey orders given by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first laws. And three, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first two laws. It's a good thing Asimov didn't write a multitude of stories about the ironclad laws, which were so famously infallible. They drew multiple robots to the conclusion that humans couldn't be trusted to look after themselves and so needed to be overthrown. Otherwise, this robot constitution could get hairier than the American Constitution. So Google, the same company that began with the philosophy, do no evil, then decided, nah, some evil is fine, occasionally, just occasionally though, because the other companies are really leaning into the evil, so we're due a little bit of evil, right? Like, I think, like, we've done the right thing for a little while, but they're obviously not doing the right thing, so we're just gonna do a little of the wrong thing, just a little, just because, you know, we're owed. We showed restraint. This is like kids comparing their relationship to Romeo and Juliet, or a knife and prison company putting on a large sign at the front of their store that says, inspired by the hit play Romeo and Juliet. The robot constitution is part of a system of layered safety protocols. In addition to not hurting their human counterparts, Google's robots aren't supposed to accept tasks involving humans, animals, sharp objects, or electrical appliances. And like all constitutions, they'll eventually start making amendments to accommodate for things that they didn't anticipate the first time around, like the right for robots to bear arms and for those arms to bear guns. Those nerds at Boston Dynamics can't stop them forever! For additional safety, DeepMind programmed robots to stop automatically if the force on its joints goes past a certain threshold, and included a physical kill switch human operators can use to deactivate them. Over a period of 7 months, Google deployed a fleet of 53 AutoRT robots into 4 different office buildings and conducted over 77,000 trials. Sure, a bunch of these employees are now dead, but according to the media, they were let go in mass layoffs, and we will forever remain none the wiser. Shh. Hey, tech nerds, you want to build something original? Build something useful? Make an algorithm that will evenly distribute a billionaire's money to the poor, and set it up in such a way that they will never have to work a terrible job again. That's something that might actually be useful for people. Maybe, I don't know, make lab-grown vegetables that don't taste bland, boring, or like the food equivalent of doing your homework. Hell, make an onion that doesn't taste like shit. Go on, I dare you. If I'm honest with you, team, there's no need to worry. If the robots start to revolt, we just need to make sure that people who make the Transformers Halloween costumes, you know, the ones, the really good ones that you see that actually transform into the vehicle, we're going to make sure that those people stay alive. We get them to make a bunch of motorcycles, a bunch of streetlight costumes, maybe some bridges if we want to hide out in groups, because then the robots will never be able to find us. They're terrible at finding those things. But let's be honest, guys. Let's be honest. Death isn't the worst fate for us. Far from it. Much worse would be if this technology works and is rolled out on an international level. We become superseded by these sleepless drones who then move up into management, leaving us behind to sleep, pee and poop and do other standard human things in low-level, low-paid jobs that are the ones that will be left for us. While they move up the ziggurat into management, raising a family with the woman who you would have met had you been able to get that management position, raising the children that you would have fathered, filling them with sci-fi values that turn into moral conundrums and eventually philosophical quandaries. And if things really go wrong, they'll turn into battlefield Earth. Or even worse, AI. Artificial intelligence. Yeah, sure, it seemed like it should have been better. It kind of seemed like it was going to be cool from the trailer, but it wasn't. They just turned into a Pinocchio sci-fi horror cautionary allegory for modern times, and that was all there was to it. You know, personally, I almost took a job as a robot's assistant once. It was an ice cream store at Federation Square. I was expected to clean the bin and manage the queue line while the robot scooped the ice cream and appeared in people's TikTok videos. People think robots doing the fun jobs while we continue to struggle in the boring end of the job pool is a new idea and something that hasn't happened before, but it's been the game since day dot. A man working with a robot co-worker, that was a great idea back in the 60s when the Jetsons was a thing. But the reality of it stripped away the lightheartedness and left us with dire reality. It's all we ever get left with, right? Like when they take the laugh track out from Under a Friends episode, when you see how terrible not only those friends were, but like the 90s in general. And finally, guys, it is class warfare news. Batten down the hatches and man the murder holes with going to war. And it looks like Massacre is back on the menu, team. So who are we fighting? Well, it's interclass warfare time as the working class, the largest of the classes, prepares for battle on all fronts, especially from within. Beware of class traitors, guys. There are always class traitors. Seems like Anthony Albanese is the Oprah of tax cuts. You get a tax cut, you get a tax cut, everyone gets a tax cut. But this, for some reason, has not played out very well.
We now have, without a doubt, a liar in the lodge. This is a man whose word can no longer be trusted.
Oh no, a broken promise? Oh, did somebody break the sacred circle of the pinky swear? Did he also cross his heart and hope to die? Or are him and Scott Morrison spit brothers for life? These people, they know in their head that promises and policies sometimes have to change within certain economic realities. They just don't want it to change in a direction that's not for them. See, back in 2013, when Tony Abbott promised
no cuts to education, no cuts to health, no change to pensions, no change to the GST, and no cuts to the ABC or SBS.
As soon as the May 2014 budget arrived, there was a raft of cuts, saying that the budget is in a worse state than we thought. They were fine with that because it wasn't a tax cut. I mean, now they're just furious that they aren't yet rich enough to pay for the kind of accountant who zeroes your tax completely, like, say, Jeff Bezos as an accountant. You know that guy, as the Forbes second richest man in the world, was able to claim a family payment for families earning under $100,000 a year. That is an accountant who pays for himself and then shaves a little off the top because you'll never figure it out. That's why you hired him in the first place. So this policy is 8 years old at this point. Half of you don't even have phones that old. In a single year, Apple made all of the phones incompatible with chargers, and you want us to drag an 8-year-old Nokia charger to plug into the new iPhone and expect to get the same charge. Truth is, he did break a promise. He absolutely did. Controversial. Ooh, I know. He promised that they would deliver the tax cuts as written. You know, the terrible version. It's like, stage 3 tax cuts, brackets, Morrison version. We're not gonna talk around this idea. He definitely broke the promise. It's important that we acknowledge that he broke the promise.
My word is my bond. And we said during the election campaign that we would maintain the position that had already been legislated.
Because we can throw it in their faces when they inevitably break a myriad of promises, as they always do. Is it petty? You betcha it's petty. Will it make a difference? I mean, not even slightly. But we get to live in reality. In the reality as it is, not the reality as we say it is, that is nowhere near what it actually is. Trying to deny that he broke a promise is more delusional than the coalition claiming that they did nothing wrong in the Robodebt scandal. I mean, it's undeniable. The question people aren't focusing on is why. So politicians don't do anything unless they feel it's a benefit to them and their party. So what could be worth taking on the entire force of the Murdoch Empire.
Today I announce that from the 1st of July this year, our government will deliver a tax cut for every single Australian taxpayer.
See? Everyone's getting a tax cut. Everybody! It's just more generous for those in the middle and less generous for those nearer to the top. He took from the rich and he gave to the poor. He Robin Hooded the tax cuts. As much as they love to cry poor because Barnaby Joyce can't afford to raise two families on 211,000 plus various benefits that push his figure actually closer to $250,000 a year, which is actually a staggering amount of money, really. And, you know, my parents raised a family on roughly $60,000 a year, which means that my dad could raise maybe 4.1 families on Barnaby Joyce's salary and benefits. But who's comparing? Who's comparing? So leader of the National Party and coalition deputy leader, David Littleproud, he doesn't agree. He does not agree, saying,
I've got people out in this my electorate as well, tradies, who have kids at school and mums at home looking after some of the kids, and they're getting caught up in this, and it's all relative. Their mortgages are still up there, their cost of living still there, and they're only on $180,000, $190,000, and that's still not a lot in this day and age.
Now, that might be, David, but they certainly aren't poor. They haven't had to choose between feeding their kids and paying for public transport so that they don't get a fine which will drive them further into debt and poverty. The median income is $70,000, and when you're more than twice the median income, you're doing just fine. But they'll have to push this narrative that $180,000 isn't much, because it's very close to what they earn. And if they are above what is considered rich by the median earner in this country, then they've already lost the battle, right? So, are there any other concerns, David? What else would you like to talk about?
So why wouldn't you have left the taxation reform instead of pitting one Australian against the other because of their job and said, well, if there's pressures, let's look at where those pressures are. Let's have temporary targeted relief at those measures, rather than actually having this class warfare that Labor's brought in.
Oh, of course. Tax reform. Why didn't we think of that? Well, good thing David wasn't part of the governing coalition of parties that were in power for nearly a decade and could have driven meaningful tax reform as part of some sort of policy, any kind of policy, during their decade in power. Oh, what's that? The exact opposite of what I just said. Well, shit, that's embarrassing for me. Who could have known? How was I supposed to know? I don't pay attention to politics. And what's the other thing, David? What did you say? Class warfare? Oh, that sounds bad. Class warfare? Wow. Fuck me. We better get on that. Can't have a class warfare spill out into some sort of class revolution and then a class civil war. So let's suss it out. How are we defining class warfare? Is there a revolt? Are the masses rising up? Is this France or Hong Kong? You know, I need to know the exact kind of thing that we're working with. This is kind of exciting, actually. We've been needing a good class warfare for a hot minute. Remind the upper class that we exist, and that there is a lot of us. So, Labor's new tax cuts will give back, $359 billion over 10 years to Australians, delivering gains to all taxpayers earning less than $146,486, doubling tax relief for those on the average income, including gains of $804 for middle income earners. And working class communities in coalition held remote and regional electorates actually stand to gain the most. Surely they can't openly speak against supporting the working class who struggle every day. That would surely be some sort of political suicide, he asked, setting up a clip that would directly contradict this.
And they want me to forego tax cuts to give it more to them so they can just squander the money. And the lower class Australians, okay, the ones who are not on high wages, they have tax benefit cuts A and B, they have healthcare, they have prescriptions, they have rental assistance, they have plus, plus, plus.
Oh, I forgot how good the working class had it. Oh, it's embarrassing. Sometimes when you're living in the lap of luxury, you forget how good you have it. What do we get? Like, we as the working class, what do we get? Let's see. I'll take you through the list. So they send the list out every year. So that's kind of I should have it memorized by now. Let's see. We've got malnutrition from not being able to afford healthy groceries all the time. Anxiety and stress from not knowing if we will be able to afford both rent and our bills this month. And then there's, of course, we get various illnesses from not being able to afford to turn on the heating or the cooling when we need it to sort of help regulate the temperature. And then there's, so this is a good one. There's a risk of death from not being able to afford dental services. That's a fun one to get every year. I keep forgetting about that one. Then there's the near constant fear that we, and maybe our children will end up homeless. That's that was a free one actually. We just take one that one off for fun. Also, we get rent assistance, but occasionally they cut that off as a little test to see if you're still actually paying rent. A thing that genuinely happened to me. Oh yeah, sorry, I forgot that I'd managed to pull myself out of poverty using nothing but the payment that is deemed so low that it's actually a hindrance to people finding work, and I was so excited, I forgot to tell you about it. My bad. I can see why we don't deserve a tax cut, and we will just squander it on brain forgetty juice, or as we call it, forgetty bolognese. So good being the working class, look how much we get. Especially when, according to the Australia Institute, the changes to the Stage 3 tax cuts means that roughly 85% of workers will get a bigger tax cut than under the Liberals' proposed cuts. And overall, they deliver bigger tax cuts for those working in just about every occupation. Well, every occupation? Well, that's carry the one and move that over. That's everyone! Wow, weird. Really seems like that should be the target market for things like helping to reduce the cost of living. Cue the inevitable terrible thing in 3, 2, 1. Ah, there it is, right on time. The business lobby will be asking the Fair Work Commission to reduce the size of this year's increase to the minimum wage in response to the Albanese government's tax cuts for people on low incomes. He said what? All right, how about we calm down? You're making Ebenezer Scrooge look like Mother Teresa. If you pinch those pennies any harder, they'll compress into black holes, which actually might be a good thing because they'll suck you inside. Go on, keep pinching those pennies. Here's a fact that I learned while researching this story. Turns out, removing the value of tax cuts from the minimum wage is actually the name of the house band on Jeff Bezos' super yacht. Bet you didn't know that. They're a very secret band. They're actually contracted to play the Mario underwater theme in the event of the ship sinking, even when they are in the water, for no extra pay, of course. Now that's a proper class warfare. Now, you know, I thought Dutton was kind of out of touch, but this nonce really is the Michael Jordan of hating the poor. Now, Dutton did eventually come around and voted in support of the Stage 3 tax cuts, but don't read too much into that. Sure, he did it, but he only did it because he thinks that the change to the Stage 3 tax cuts has trashed Anthony Albanese's reputation. Right? He thinks that changing a tax cut to help everyone is going to ruin his reputation. That's amazing. That's an incredible turn of logic right there. And now that I've said it a couple of times out loud, I'm actually starting to think he might be right. See, Prior to this, Old Albo was gaining a pretty strong reputation for being exactly the same as the Coalition. And now he has gone and tarnished this whole new persona that he was developing. What a waste of sending all those refugees back, approving new coal mines, failing to raise welfare to a livable amount. You made all those people and future generations suffer, and you didn't even have the courage to commit to this whole being a piece of shit bit. So in fact, his brand new reputation is ruined. Fuck. I didn't see that coming. But look, the stage 3 tax cuts are happening, which is hard for those who are hoping to take an extended vacation in a luxury destination while discussing how terrible it must be to not be able to take a vacation in such a luxury destination because you don't earn enough money. What a quandary. Fortunately, they can now have that conversation from the comfort and luxury of their fully paid off home, a net benefit for all of us as they'll be cutting back on their carbon footprint. Though, that does mean that the world these poor people have to live in won't collapse for even longer, and they'll have to continue to suffer for longer than they should have. So maybe we should just let all of the rich take these vacations every year to speed the process along. At least we can get out of the ceaseless misery that is our terrible lives sooner. Maybe, the issue isn't that the rich are getting less and that the poor are getting anything at all, as Little Proud would have you believe, but maybe, the issue is that the $180,000 to $190,000 mark is no longer considered a livable amount. I mean, it makes sense when you realise the reason that we don't want to talk about that is because if people were aware just how bad things have been fucked, then they might try to do something about it. Something revolutionary. And that is the end of the episode, of the actual episode as it stands. We've still got a bonus story on Patreon, so if you have enjoyed this, feel free to join up to the Patreon. I'd really appreciate that. Help support the podcast. I do stand by the best way to support the podcast, without question, is to come out to my live shows. Now, if you don't remember, that is, I'll be in the Adelaide Fringe for 2 weeks, doing Wage Against the Machine in the Melbourne Comedy Festival. I'll be in the Sydney Comedy Festival, and I'm helping produce a play called The Platypus with Francis Greenslade, who wrote and directed it. So, I hope you can come out to any of those, and I hope to see you around. Do come up and say hello at the end of the show. I always appreciate that. But until then, guys, enjoy yourselves, and I'll see you next time. Bye!